Thank you, Dr. Jones, for having me once again. My name is Chicago Talk Show host, and I'm here with the esteemed E. Michael Jones. I believe E. Michael Jones is the most important Catholic writer and intellectual of our time. He is the author of several books, such as Degenerate Moderns, Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control, Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as a Conflict Between Labor and Usury, Logos Rising, which is the first book I read of his, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, The Dangers of Beauty, The Conflict Between Mimesis and Concupiscence and the Fine Arts, and of course, the most recent and the biggest released, The Holocaust Narrative. Dr. Jones, let's start off there. How has the public received your latest book, The Holocaust Narrative?
Well, actually, I was surprised because I was anticipating pushback from the Jews. Obviously, this is an important thing for them. And there was absolutely no response. So this is not necessarily a good thing. It's the first line of defense against any assault on Jewish narrative is called dynamic silence. So they will pretend that you don't exist. And that's what they're doing. They have no way of dealing with this book, and so they're just going to pretend that it doesn't exist and try to just ban me. The surprise came, though, from the other side of the equation, which is basically the, how am I going to describe this without being polemical, the Nazis, let's say, the white boys, the racial crowd. They were upset by this book, and they were upset in particular by one particular chapter, and that was the chapter on Father Lentz. The final chapter in the book is a critique or an analysis of Father Lentz's book, Christus in Dachau. Father Lentz was a priest from Austria. Austria had been taken over by the Nazis early on, and they were one of the first groups to come to Dachau, which was the first concentration camp. Dachau was created primarily for Catholics, because Catholics in 1933 were the main opposition to the Nazi regime at this point. The Nazis wanted to have total control of education, and at this point they bumped into the Catholic Church, which contested that area. Things like the Boy Scouts. There was a Catholic Boy Scouts. The Nazis did not want any type of Catholic Boy Scouts, so they made them abolish the Catholic Boy Scouts, and all of these people were inducted into the Hitlerjugend. So what happened here is basically what you see now is that there are two groups that don't like what I said. The Jews don't like it, and the white boys don't like it. Because I brought up, they were basically in total agreement about the substance of the Holocaust narrative, which is basically Nazis versus Jews. And when you bring up the Catholic participationists, they don't know what to say, and neither side liked it. And so a lot of the attacks were from the white boys, the Nazis, I don't know how you want to describe these people, who basically be an ad hominem attack against Father Lentz. And basically the logic is Hitler was a good man. So Jews say Hitler was a bad man. Nazis say Hitler was a good man. And so therefore he could never do something like this, call it persecuting Catholics. He would never do that. And so therefore, these priests who ended up in Dachau must have done something wrong. That's the logic here. And so then they kind of come up with, well, what did they do wrong? Well, the Concordat, they said you weren't allowed, said that it wasn't allowed to, priests were not allowed to engage in political activity. So they must have engaged in political activity, because otherwise it wouldn't be there. Well, who determines what political activity is? Well, the Nazis do. The Gestapo determined what political activity was. And so in the article which is just in the most recent issue of Culture Wars, I talked about Heinrich Brüning, the chancellor before Hitler, who helped create the Concordat between the Nazis, Germany, and the Vatican. In retrospect, he said the biggest problem we had was who gets to determine this? There was no independent body that could adjudicate political activity. So that gave them the opening. And then it launched into a whole bunch of other stuff, basically attacking any Catholic priest who ended up in a concentration camp must have done something wrong, and he deserved to be there. So that was the surprise reaction I had.
Interesting. I also want to mention that on that topic, I know you do a weekly show every Friday, and it's wonderful, EMJ Live, and you can find it on Cozy. And the links are in the description. And one thing that I value about your weekly show is you also have a range of different guests and different hosts that you appear on. And there's two in particular that I'd like to comment on. The whole Jim Rizzoli debate hosted by Gemma, I listened to that, and I remember listening, and I remember thinking, how can this man speak about these things in history and not cite anything as far as work? That he's going off of hearsay or opinion and having this intellectual meeting of the minds, and it seemed incongruent. That stood out to me, and I agree with you. I agree that the person who is going to speak about things needs to showcase their evidence and where they're getting the information from, which is, I think, was something that you continually mentioned during that in particular interview. The second one that I think stood out was with Brother Nathaniel.
Okay, well, let's deal with Jim Rizzoli first.
Okay.
So what did Father Lentz encounter when he ended up at the concentration camp? Okay, you've got they're ready to go to war. They've got a manpower shortage in Germany because they're building up this big army. Where are they going to get the guards for the concentration camp? Well, they went to prisons. It's what the Irish did during World War I. They were fighting a war, and so they went, emptied the prisons, put uniforms on them, in this instance, SS uniforms, and they put them in charge of the priests. Well, who were these priests? Well, they were criminals. And Lentz and the other priests knew some of these people. Well, they were rebels against the social order. They hated the Catholic Church in Austria because it was the guarantor of the social order, and so they took out their anger on the priest. That's what happened there. So I'm trying to explain this to Jim Rizzoli. Jim Rizzoli has a kind of a priori view of the argument. So I mentioned it before, but basically he thinks Hitler was a good man, therefore he would never have done this, therefore because they were there, they did something wrong.
Right.
And that was, so at that point, other people joined in and they sent me information. I kept saying to Jim, what's the evidence? Give me the evidence. Well, he couldn't do anything. At one point, he said something he didn't read. He doesn't read. Then he corrected me in an email saying, I do read. But anyway, he couldn't come up with the evidence. Other people came up with the evidence, and it simply wasn't convincing. Again, don't take my word for it. It's in the article that I'm mentioning in the April issue. I think it's in the first part is in the March issue, and then the second part will be in the April issue. So if you subscribe and get the magazine, you'll have all the details. But basically, so what do we have here? Well, it's a Gestapo report. Well, they're not impartial observers here. There was no impartial tribunal.
Right.
And so in order to get around this, I decided, well, I got to go to other sources. And so again, I went to the testimony of Father Kenterich, who also ended up in Dachau at the same time that Lentz was there. And he substantiated Lentz's account of what happened in Dachau, but also told the background of what it was like. I think he was in Trier, and you know, what it was like before they ended up there. So then I took it a step further and went to a memoir by Father Fitkow, who was in East Prussia. So this story is not so much the beginning, which is like Austria when they ended up there in the 30s. This is toward the end of World War II. So here is Father Fitkow being interrogated by the Nazis. They're going to throw him in jail because he's undermining the war effort. Okay, that's the beginning of that story. And then suddenly, we're talking about 1945 here. He became a pastor in the fall of 44 in Zuzenberg. And then 45, well, the Soviet army is coming through. And so now they enter into the situation and now they arrest him. And they say he's pro-Nazi. The Nazis arrested him, said he was pro-Russian. Now the Russians arrest him and say he's pro-Nazi. And then again, you have the same thing where this guy who's the Soviet commissar who's interrogating him finally explodes. You know, just the charade that this is some type of objective legal procedure. He explodes and says, "We're going to exterminate all you priests." Well, that's what they had in common. Both the Nazis and the communists hated the Catholic Church.
Right.
And did whatever was in their power to destroy it. Well, this is why this Catholic narrative has never emerged. This is a whole new story here. Because the story of the Holocaust narrative is basically, it got hijacked. Lenz's book came out in 1955. The point of Lenz's book is that, first of all, Germany is being punished because of godlessness. I mean, think of Nietzsche and the effect that Nietzsche had on Germany at that point. But the priests were chosen to expiate that sin through their suffering. So suffering has a purpose. Lenz tells about how suddenly the word came down for Berlin to basically stop the sadistic treatment because they needed these people to work. And he said if that had continued, Lenz said if this had continued, we all would have died of starvation. So now God lifted the punishment. It had to go for another 2 years, and then they finally released. And that's the story. That was the Holocaust story, the Holocaust narrative. It wasn't called the Holocaust at that point, but this is the narrative of the concentration camps at this point. And that comes out in 1955, and there's kind of like a universal agreement among the Germans that there was a spiritual renewal going on there. And then 3 years later, the Jews hijacked the narrative. And I'm talking about the publication of Night, La Nuit. It came out in French. Elie Wiesel was given the author. He didn't write it. It was François Mauriac. Elie Wiesel wrote a memoir in Yiddish. And Mauriac had to translate into elegant French. He had already won the Nobel Prize. And now the paradigmatic concentration camp is no longer Dachau. Now it's Auschwitz. Now Catholic suffering has completely been erased. And it's been replaced by Jewish suffering, where the only people who suffer, they have a monopoly on the suffering. And more importantly, the message has changed. So if Lenz said suffering has a purpose and we're being punished for our atheism, Elie Wiesel now says God died at Auschwitz. That's a direct quote from, so it's propaganda for atheism.
It honestly sounds like the suffering has been weaponized as well. And I want to mention a couple of things as far as what you mentioned. I read Christ in Dachau, and I did a book review on it as well on my channel. And it's, Father Lenz quickly points out that not all the German people were with the Nazis. A lot of the Germans had disdain for them and shame from reading that book. And it is clear when Father Lenz writes in that book, Christ in Dachau, the pleasure, the sadistic nature of the guards and how they loved to torture and persecute, and if they can get away with it, kill priests, not just any priest, but Catholic priests in particular. And he makes that very clear in all of its horror that Father Lenz and those priests had to endure. That being said, I also wanted to mention, as we shift towards another guest that you most recently had, Brother Nathaniel. That was the first time I actually listened to him because by virtue of your show. And the one thing that stood out to me, there were a few things that stood out to me, but one thing in particular was right around the 32-minute mark, Brother Nathaniel says, quote, "I'm a Christian now, racially I'm a Jew," end quote.
You see, I'm a Christian now, racially I am a Jew. Just look at me, everyone knows that.
So this made me do a double take, because I've been reading your books, particularly The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. I'm working my way through it. And from what my understanding is that the primary identification or qualifying identifier for the Jew is someone who rejects Christ. And this idea of race, racially being a Jew, is not accurate. Is that correct in my understanding?
Yeah. I said the premise of the Jewish revolutionary spirit is that the Jews took on this identity at the time of the crucifixion of Christ, and that it is a theological construct, and that there's nothing biological about the Jewish revolutionary spirit. It can't be biological if it took place at the time of Christ, because the antagonists both shared the same DNA. So the Pharisees who urged Pilate to crucify him, the Jewish people who said, his blood be on us and our people, they had the same DNA as the Blessed Mother, who stood beneath the cross and prayed for her son. St. John was also there too. She didn't yell, crucify him. So the whole term of race in this regard is meaningless. So if the Jewish identity is rejection of Logos, if the Jew rejects the rejection of Logos, he's no longer a Jew. And this has been substantiated at the time of World War II. Oswald Rufeisen was a Jew who was a double agent in Poland, trying to work with the Nazis, but really working with the Jews, telling them when the next pogrom was going to take place. They found out he hid out in a Carmelite convent. At that point, he became Catholic, and then he continued there, and he became a priest. Okay, so then the state of Israel gets founded, and he thinks, well, I'll go to Israel and I'll become a citizen there. Well, they wouldn't allow him to become a citizen, because they admitted that if you become a Christian, okay, you were no longer a Jew. You have rejected the rejection, so you're no longer a Jew. Well, what's that got to do? He became a Christian because the baptism water poured on his, did that change his DNA? No. So the whole issue of race is completely irrelevant. I keep trying to explain this, and it's really a hard lesson for a lot of people. But this is, I think Brother Nathaniel confused the issue by bringing race into it. I think what he meant to say, I'm putting words in his mouth here. Who am I? Sorry, Brother Nathaniel. But anyway, I think what he meant is ethnically. So ethnically, he's a Jew. Well, that's true. Okay, because he was raised a Jew in Pittsburgh. Nathaniel Kapner, raised a Jew, studied the Talmud, knows a lot about the Talmud, has all of these experiences which formed him. So, you know, if you're talking about, well, what type of food do you like? Well, maybe it's Jewish food. Maybe you like gefilte fish. I think that's disgusting. But maybe if you grow up with that type of thing, that's what you like. And I think that's what he's talking about here. And I think what came out to me in the interview was a kind of Jewish persona. There's still a kind of Jewish persona here.
I want to second that. I also picked up on it. Now, I value the interview, no disrespect, but I did pick up on that. I was listening to it, and I was like, gosh, there's an awful lot of built up resentment for goys and the disparaging way that, and I'm like, wait a minute. If someone converted to Christian, this is not how you speak to your brother, your sister. We don't use terms like goy, but the way that he still seemed to harbor this specter of disdain for non-Gentile.
I have to say, I didn't pick that up.
Okay.
I didn't pick up any disdain for the goy. Of course, he's going to use the word goyim. Every time he wants to talk about the way Jews talk about the insider language, you have to use goyim or goy when you're talking about that. What I picked up was a kind of cynicism. Like every time I try and say, here's a sign of hope or a sign of things, that doesn't matter. The Jews are still in control. That was the sense I got, that there's that kind of cynicism. Maybe that's a residual. There is. So let's take a step back again. How do you be an American? This is my new topic. You know, I'm working on this thing. What does it mean to be an American? Because I got an email from a guy. He said, I can trace my family back here to 1683. And he said, I became a Catholic because I listened to your podcast and read your books. But I don't know what it means to be an American anymore. And so being an American is something you learn. and largely because you came from somewhere else, fairly recently. So if you're a Mexican, you probably came really recently. If you're Irish, my father was Irish, his grandfather came in 1900. When you come over here, you brought your European culture with you, but now what's it mean to be an American? Well, an American, Samuel Huntington wrote a book called Who Are We? And he said, basically, if you're an American, you're an Anglo-Protestant. This is an Anglo-Protestant country. So if you're a Mexican, you got two strikes against you, you know? I mean, we all have strikes against us, but if you're like a French Catholic or a Mexican Catholic or whatever, you know, Irish Catholic, you got, what does it mean? Does that mean I'm not an American? Well, in some sense, that's true. But this is up for grabs now, because you have all these people come together, and this is the review I did in the, it'll be out in the most, in the next issue, the April issue, of Emmanuel Todt's book. This is a Frenchman who's talking about the United States right now, and the book is called La Défaite de l'Occident, and it's only in French, so you got to read it in French if you want to read it. But the premise is that basically the American Empire is imploding right now; it's collapsing because the hidden grammar or the form of the American Empire, which is Protestantism, has disappeared. It's evaporated. Well, when what he's saying is that when the form disappears, you don't know how to act. And when you don't know how to act, you're creating violence. Because that's the only way you can relate if you don't know how to, if there are no forms of politeness. You know, I mean, politeness way down, that disappeared a long time ago. So what happens if you want the same seat in the subway? Well, before, if you were a young man and it was an older woman, you would stand up and give that lady your seat because that's the way people act. Well, that's, we don't think that way anymore. And so you've got all these videos now of fist fights in subways, fist fights in schools. There are fist fights all over the place. Fist fights at spring break in Florida now because the form has disappeared. But I'm saying the back to Brother Nathaniel, we all have to learn, in a sense, how to be an American. So the Jews solved this problem simply by taking over America. So basically, in order to become an American, you have to become a Jew now. And I've said, I'm not exaggerating here. I think, first of all, I became a Jew when I was in college because I was in Philadelphia. I had a priest who introduced me to the art world, and I wanted to be part of the art world, and that was Jewish. And I did it unconsciously. I didn't know I was doing that. It's only in retrospect. I think I stopped being a Jew when I went to Germany to teach because I was in a Catholic culture, taken out of Philadelphia as a Catholic culture, Catholic part of Germany, and I came back to the faith. Okay? But we've got this, you know, I think another example is any Catholic woman who has had an abortion becomes a Jew. Now, obviously, you can repent, but a lot of people didn't. And they converted to the new Jewish religion, which is called feminism. Feminism is a Jewish religion that is also a political movement, and it's a part of the Democratic Party and one of the main parts of the Democratic Party. And that's why they're so adamant about supporting abortion. So you have a situation like Pennsylvania. I watched the sexual liberation of those, my generation, the girls who went to the Catholic high schools, academies outside of Philadelphia. They all got sexually liberated. When you get sexually liberated, you chances are you're going to get pregnant. When you get pregnant, then you have to make a choice, and some of them chose abortion. And they're the ladies who became Jews. And how do we know they're Jews? Because they vote like Jews. And how do we know they vote like Jews? Because they elected Josh Shapiro, governor of Pennsylvania, an anti-Catholic Jew who made a name for himself by persecuting the Catholic Church in Harrisburg before he ran. So these are all the identity issues that come in to be an American. So here you got Brother Nathaniel, who's a Jew, which has a very strong identity in America, which he's repudiated. Okay, so now you got a vacuum. And he's become Orthodox, okay, which has essentially no identity in America. The Orthodox have been so such an insignificant group. America is three ethnic groups based on three religions, Protestant, Catholic, Jew. The Orthodox are still insignificant in numbers. The Muslims have become more important at this point. And at this point, so what's it mean to be a Muslim and an American? Well, I don't know. You go to Dearborn, you can ask them. I don't think they know. What does it mean to be Orthodox now? It means nothing. You have no role models whatsoever. And I'm saying this is part of the issue, I think, that that Brother Nathaniel's facing. So he's very consciously creating this persona, the Orthodox persona, by putting on this costume, you know, which is kind of shocking. Shocked everyone. He has a white one too, and he'd stand out on the streets holding signs, and everybody, it was, you know, very striking. But it's sui generis. I'm saying Catholics face the same problem, and I don't think they ever solved the problem. I think the closest they came would be Notre Dame University, which was the place that gave you the Catholic identity of, like, and it was enshrined in a Hollywood movie called I think it's called The Newt Rockne Story, where basically you have Ronald Reagan playing the Gipper, and you have Pat O'Brien, and they brought them together, I think in 1980, for the commencement address at Notre Dame, and you had this American Catholic identity certified by Hollywood, Bing Crosby and Going My Way, or so on and so forth. But eventually it failed because Notre Dame totally capitulated to the American religion, which is Satanism. And they ended up endorsing contraception. They work with the Rockefellers to attack contraception. Then it becomes abortion. Then it becomes homosexuality. And now they even came out, a priest came out and endorsed transgenderism. Well, you destroyed your role as Americanizer of the Catholic faith by doing that. You have to retain some type of Catholic identity. Who has done that? Well, I'll give you one example, John F. Kennedy. And look what happened to him. I think he was murdered because, first of all, he was murdered. Jeffrey Sachs has just come out with a new book on Kennedy. I saw the interview yesterday, and he said basically Kennedy was murdered by the CIA. Now, he was murdered, the proximate cause was because he was going to end the Cold War. He's going to kill the CIA, end the Cold War, and make peace with the Soviet Union, specifically with Khrushchev. And at that point, the CIA said, no, we're going to kill him, and they killed him. So this is the abortion of American Catholic identity. It was happening. You had paradigmatic Americans like Gary Cooper became a Catholic. John Wayne became a Catholic. All these paradigms of what it meant to be American, they were all becoming Catholic, and the WASP elite understood that. The Jews allied with the WASP elite, and they killed Kennedy and created a whole new regime.
Wow. You know, in listening to that, when I heard you first, out of one of the things that stood out to me out of all the things you said, all of it stood out to me, but the question, what it means to be an American, And I got to tell you, growing up here, grandparents from Mexico, parents, first generation Americans, and I grew up here in Chicago. And what happened was, for our family, it was never about like, okay, we're in America, but let's still celebrate Mexican culture. It wasn't quite like that. I mean, we had Mexican food and stuff like that, and quinceañeras in the family, but we weren't about to like drive on the street and wave a Mexican flag, right? And even as a young kid, I understood that there was something different, even as a grade schooler. And I remember asking my mom, I'm like, are we Mexican or are we American? Or what's going on here? I was like 6 or 7. And I started realizing that, okay, well, let's embrace, I want to be American, considered American. So I embraced American culture. And For me personally, there was never a conflict of interest. I always cherished the history of the country, the people that brought it up, all these things that happened with the country. That's great and everything. However, this brings me to my next point. I've been seeing a lot on X that has to do with racial division, and this whole idea of constantly I see on X, and I think it's done by agent provocateurs, white people this, black, brown people that. And it's constantly like, oh, look what they're doing to us white people. Look at them, right? And I see this narrative happening all the time, and I think it's on purpose because they want to create quite frankly, it seems like they want to create another civil war, and they want to provoke violence, which is not the response. Anyone who's smart out there, no, don't do that. But it seems like they want to keep pushing and they want to keep poking this race division. And I see this, I think, with it also morphs into another form, Christian nationalism. And so when I hear that, I think to myself, are you a nationalist for the great Satan? Is that what you're supporting? And it seems to me that, like, when the people who are quick to proudly say that they're Christian nationalists are the same people who romanticize Hitler, they're the same people who romanticize the Nazis, because they love it. Let's be honest, they love it. They see the brown masses coming through the border, they see the Mexicans, and it's not just Mexicans, but they see these brown masses come through the border and they think, I am not like them. Okay, maybe my parents used to be Christian or Catholic, but not me. I see all these, for all intents and purposes, this is the way the vibe I get. I see these brown people and I'm not like them. Never mind that some of these Mexicans are also deeply Catholic with deep Catholic roots, but there's lots of disdain. And I see so much romanticization because they want their Bar Kokhba. It seems to me that they want that military leader. They don't, they think Jesus, but.
Yeah. This is one of the weird things about Brother Nathaniel. He's also promoting the secession of Idaho from the Union. That's a kind of bizarre corollary of what he moved to Idaho. That's a hotbed of that type of spirit that you're talking about. But, I mean, to get back to the fundamental issue, I mean, what are Mexicans? They're the cosmic race. I was in Guadalajara when I realized this. I'm thinking, what am I going to do here? I was invited by Mexicans who were honoring this guy who wrote a book about the Nazis, a Mexican, who felt that the Nazis should have won the war and that the wrong side won the war. And so are they Nazis? And then every speech, and they say, Viva Cristo Rey. So they were Cristeros who had their own political allegiance, which was deeply Catholic. So I'm meditating on this, and I'm looking at, I was in a church looking at Our Lady of Guadalupe. There's a stained glass window of her. And I suddenly realized, well, this is race mixing. If there's a one group, it was a mixture of Europeans, the Spaniards, and the indigenous people, the Indians, in Mexico. Well, that's Catholic. The same thing happened in Canada, where the French came. There was no understanding of race whatsoever there. It was basically everyone was Catholic. The Indians converted to Catholicism largely because of the Jesuits, and then they intermarried. So by the time the English showed up after Wolfe conquered Quebec, the Presbyterians show up in Nova Scotia and they say, well, you've got to become Christian now. Well, they spoke French and they spoke Mi'kmaq because they had intermarried for about 100 years. And they're saying, no, we're already Christian. No, you have to this, blah, blah, blah. And so it was two completely different worldviews. It's the Protestant and the Catholic. And the Protestants all ended up with national churches. So in a sense, it meant you being Protestant meant you were an Englishman. And meant being an Englishman meant you were a Protestant. And so as a result, there's no other Christian denomination that you deal with. So it naturally led to racism. And racism was the essence of the English colonization. There was no intermarriage here. When the Puritans landed in Massachusetts, there was a little guy, a guy named Elliot, who tried to convert the Indians. They said, to hell with it. We're just going to kill the Indians. That's the march westward, was the spread of the white race. And this is you're confronted with this when you come here. So what am I? Huntington, the same Huntington I mentioned, said that wrote a book called The Hispanic Challenge. And it was about the Mexicans. It was written in 1992. And he said that all these Mexicans are coming over. It's a completely different situation now because everyone else had to come by boat. And now these people can walk across the border if they want. You know, and that's never happened before. The only an analog was basically the Roman Empire, where the Goths could simply walk or sail across the Danube And when they did that, that was the collapse of the Roman Empire because they couldn't assimilate them. So there's going to be some type of fundamental change here. Now, this doesn't have to be a conflict if you take the Catholic point of view. And this is part of what is the battle here. Are we white? I keep telling people, I'm not white. I'm Irish and German. I was never white. I mean, over there, you're not white. I keep telling the Irish now, you're not white. Because this is the head of, premier of the Taoiseach, the premier of Ireland. He's a homosexual Indian. How's this guy head of Ireland? Anyway, he says, I see too many white people out there. No, there are no white people out there. They're called Irish. They're not white. They're Irish and they're Catholic. And if you think there's some type of racial issue here, you're wrong. The fundamental issue in Irish history is the conflict between Catholics and Protestants. If you don't understand that, you don't understand anything. And now they're trying to impose this racial narrative on a group of people where it's totally alien. And believe it or not, there are some Irish who are stupid enough to identify with their oppressors by calling themselves white. This is the fundamental crisis right now. How are we going to... Now, I am saying, I am going to admit to you that this migration is being weaponized. There's absolutely no question. You got Mayorkas, who was head of HIAS, which is this Hebrew organization to promote migration. They are bringing, this is weaponized migration to destroy American culture. And it has to stop, okay? It's not Mexicans, it's anybody they want to send across the border. The same thing happened to me in Philadelphia in the 1950s, where the weaponization was of black people from North and South Carolina. They were brought in and basically to destroy the ethnic neighborhoods, which is what happened. So I was born into an Irish neighborhood, and then when I was 6 years old, they moved me to what was de facto a suburb, where you become white. You're no longer Irish, you're mixed in, and that's the same thing that's happening now throughout Europe, and it's happening now. So on the one hand, we have to understand that there is a weaponization that's going on, but on the other hand, from an objective point of view, there is a solution to this problem, and the solution is the Catholic Church. Because in Mexico or in Canada, the Catholic Church never understood its identity as racial. The Catholic Church cannot understand its identity as racial. Cannot. There are too many racial groups in it. So you can't have that in a way that you have, like Norway. Well, yeah, it's racial. England, Scandinavia, all of those countries are basically one small group of people, all who look alike, all who share the same DNA, and they have a state church. So obviously that's going to lend itself to a kind of ethnocentrism in the way that the Catholic Church is not.
You know, as I digest all that information and I think back about our country, and I think about the response that you received from both ends regarding the Holocaust narrative, and I think to myself, for aside from the Jews, the people who romanticize the Nazis, it seems that they don't want to let go of America for one, and I get it to some degree. It's like for its history and this sense of Americana, which is great. I grew up in the 90s, and that part of that American culture, I think, was the last great time period before everything changed into modernity, in my opinion. And it seems that they don't want to let go. They won't let go of America, even though the dollar is on its way out and the economy, I think, is being purposefully destroyed and imploded from the inside because they want to make way for this blockchain cryptocurrency that's fed that's going to be run by Big Brother. The country itself is mired in and connected to genocide. The genocide in Palestine. Our taxpayer money is funding it. There's abortion left and right. There's a devoid of morality. You know this, but they will not let it go. And it seems to me and I think about this, like, you call yourself a Christian nationalist, and it's like, wait a minute. When was the last time you went to church? Are you going to church? Do you go to mass? When was the last time you read the Bible? Because if you have, then you would know in Book of Revelations, I don't come across, it's seek God first. I don't see anything about go ahead and try to save America, or go ahead and save your people. It's like, no, the destination for Catholics is salvation and going to heaven. But people, they hear that message and they're just like, no, we want to save America, and we want to protect white people as much as we can. And this is the kind of sentiment that I pick up on X all the time. And I think that's incredible folly. And I think we need what you're getting at. We need more Catholic unity.
Well, I mean, I've said before, what's a white boy? Is a Protestant doesn't go to church anymore. Unless you're Jim Godin, then it's a Catholic who doesn't go to church anymore. But I think what you're seeing is the abandoning of your identity. Because the identity, ethnic identity in America is religious. Triple melting pot, Protestant, Catholic, Jew. If you abandon any of those identities, you're going to create a vacuum. And first of all, why did you abandon your identity? The interview with Jim Godin is really interesting. Because, you know, Jim Godin was raised a Catholic. We both went to Temple University. We both grew up in Philadelphia. Well, the big change in Jim Godin was sexual liberation. Basically, he decided to become a libertine. And when he did that, he didn't like what the church had to say about that. So he's now anti-Catholic. And he became white because nature abhors a vacuum. This is the story of America. And Paul Johnson, in his book, Intellectuals, talks about Ralph Waldo Emerson. He says he's the first American. I think he's right. He is the first American. And he went over to England and berated Carlyle and the Romantics over there because they assumed that sexual morality had evaporated in America. And he said, no, it didn't. It's still the norm in America. Most people who get married, they're virgins when they get married. This is an essential part of what it meant to be, let me put it this way, it's an essential part that kept the Satanism of Protestantism under control. This is what Perry Miller says about Emerson. They lived bourgeois lives, but intellectually they were flaming Satanist revolutionaries because they had all read Milton, and this contradiction side by side. So Nathaniel Hawthorne grew up in this experience, knew Emerson. Emerson was a good family man. Hawthorne's a good family man. And this ethos held it together until modernity, basically. Until you get to someone like Hemingway, who is the epitome of the American, and the guy who can shoot lions in Africa and goes to war and all this other stuff. But he's a sexual reprobate. And in many ways, it compensates the aggressive masculinity is a compensation for your moral weakness. I think that's the best way you can talk about Hemingway. And that's what has been bequeathed to us. So it got refined, and when the moral law evaporated, you became a killer. And that's what they are now. That's what we are now. That's what the Israelis are. That's what the country has degenerated to. And it was obvious when your religious identity evaporates, you're going to become a Jew, which is what happened to me. It's happened to a lot of people. The entire country now is a Jewish country.
One of the things I really value about your knowledge, Dr. Jones, is you're able to pull from so many different literary sources. And it's wonderful. And one of the things that comes to mind as another contrast is one of the things you brilliantly pointed out with Jack Kerouac and On the Road. And this is months ago in one of your shows. And you had pointed out how there was like this epiphany for him when they're all in Mexico and drinking, they're playing the music loud, driving their car, and they're dancing with in Tijuana in this bar or whatever. And then Jack Kerouac, he hears in the background a baby crying. And then it kind of, there's like this moment where it's just like, wait a minute, my actions, this sexual liberty has consequences. There's consequences, right? But we gotta get high. We gotta put the music on. We gotta talk about, you know, whatever beatnik culture, what was going on at the time, and communist leading, instead of talk about consequences of the conduct that is happening as a result of this wanton sexual liberation that was human, that was happening.
Yeah, well, Jack Kerouac was a French Canadian. it came down. They came down to work in the clothing or shoe factories in Lowell, Massachusetts, and then he's comes into his own right after the war, writes a novel, and then he starts hitchhiking across the country. And there's this kind of reaction against, I think, American militarism. But the main vehicle for his loss of identity was the Negro. If you go to On the Road, there's a passage in there where he said, "I was walking in twilight through Denver, the Denver twilight, wishing I were a Negro." What's that mean? Well, you mean sexually liberated, because at that point, the main vehicle for this paradigm, the Negro as a paradigm of sexual liberation, was jazz, which had come into being during the 1920s. Jazz was Jewish creation. There's no question. It was a cultural artifact from black people, largely people in New Orleans who had picked up Civil War instruments and started to create their own kind of music. And it was almost immediately appropriated by the Jews in New York City. And they became the determinant. The Harlem Renaissance became the determinant of Negro identity, which was basically sexually liberated. That's exactly what Jack Kerouac imbibed from listening to jazz.
Really quickly, and you know what, when I talk to people who are professionally involved in music, when I talk to them about like their taste and what they like, and I say, "So how would you describe jazz music? I mean, what would you say?" And they half jokingly say, "There's no rules." And I'm thinking to myself, "Well, doesn't that make sense? Is a reflection of where jazz is coming from. It's just like, yeah, do whatever you want. It seems like that." And he said that half jokingly, but I thought that there was some sort of a connection there, as far as.
But I think that one of the keys to jazz is improvisation.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And improvisation is basically making it up as you go along. You know, let's just make it up as we're going in the middle of the thing. I'll make it up. Well, that's quintessentially American, because I'm saying when they came over here, the first settlers came over here, they had to make it up, because there was nothing there. So you have Puritans who have the Calvinistic Bible there, Calvinism, showing up, and how are we going to deal with the wilderness? Well, you had to make it up. And that's why improvisation was so important in jazz, I think.
Interesting. Moving along here, let's take a look here. I'm going to take my notes here. I have this hypothesis. Earlier, we kind of touched on it, and it had to do with this. We're seeing all kinds of videos in public of people fist fighting, right, stabbing each other, shooting each other. Maybe it's just Chicago, but anyway, I have also seen. Let me ask you this: How really quickly to kind of just switch gears from the big political stuff? Have you noticed if you're driving around, the culture around? Maybe it's probably different in South Bend compared to Chicago. I'm sure it is, but it seems to me that more people are going straight through stop signs, they're ignoring red lights, they're doing all kinds of dog-eat-dog behavior on the road. And I think that's a microcosm of a reflection of society itself. It seems that the more society becomes unhinged with reality, and the more there's the culture of narcissism, which I know you've spoken and wrote about, we end up in this place where more and more people are thinking, well, if I see that the law doesn't apply in the southern border on one macro scale, and on the micro scale, they say, well, why don't I just take the emergency side of the road and just get ahead of traffic? No one's going to stop me. Everyone else is doing it. And I see that more and more. And I honestly think that this increase in road rage, it's insane. People getting trying to one-up each other. And if they don't like it, you might end up in a gunfight. And you might get shot. And that'll be the story of you. Do you care to comment on that?
Yeah, so this is anarchy. This is what happens when you break the form. And that's exactly what Tote said about the collapse of Protestantism, which tells you how to act. So to give you an example of the way it used to be, Charles Ives, the composer, was on the subway platform in New York City when the word spread that the Lusitania had just gone down. And everyone on the platform spontaneously broke out singing In the Sweet By and By. So it shows you that they all knew this Protestant hymn, they all were part of that culture, and they all sang the same songs. Just fast forward to just last week, the announcement that the governor of New York has sent the National Guard to the subway, because there are people in New York now who will push you in front of the train as the train's coming in. just absolute lunatics. People are crazy. So what happened here? Well, you said, you know, but what's the essence of Protestantism? It's non servium. I will not serve. No one's going to tell me what to do. I'm an American. No one's going to tell me what to do. I'm going to make it up on my own. So there's an element that is good in that, but the predominant element is bad because you can't make it up on your own. You didn't create yourself. There's a law of your nature called the moral law. It's written on your heart, and you have to follow that. And that's not something that gets made up in Harrisburg or Albany. That's part of what's written on your heart. And if you think everything is up for grabs, you're going to be crazy. And that's precisely where it ended up. So you have an example. The classic example is the mystery clause in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, in which Judge Kennedy said, the essence of being American is defining your being. No, God did that. And if you think you're doing it, you're going to lead to anarchy. Well, obviously, it's being used to justify abortion, which is morally wrong. Everybody can understand that it's morally wrong, in spite of the fact that it's a Jewish sacrament. That's where it will lead. And if it's okay to kill a child in the womb, well, then why is it bad for me to push this old lady in front of the subway train? That's where it naturally leads. Now, how do you get back from that? That's the big challenge. Because all these people are saying, we don't have to follow any. I'm an American. I make it up as I go along. This is improvisation. Look at how great we are because we improvise because of the wilderness and blah, blah, blah. No, there are certain, okay, maybe it's good to a certain extent. Obviously, there was a great achievement here, but if you go one step too far, then it becomes the exact opposite. And the step too far is the moral law. That's it. You can't tell people that the moral law is a purely human creation. It is written on the heart by God. If you go against it, you will destroy the country.
That being said, it's almost like we need to recondition people to say, logos, aka limits, is not a bad thing, right? We all know that water is a good thing, but too much water and you're going to drown, right?
Right.
And so people have been brainwashed to think no limits is the best thing, and not only that, they've been brainwashed into thinking no limits is equivalent to freedom.
Right, absolutely. That's the fundamental flaw. Freedom is not the absence of limits. Freedom only exists within limitations, and the limitation is logos. You are free to be rational, which means you are free to be moral, because morality is practical reason. You are not free to be irrational. If you get into irrational behavior, you have lost your freedom, because we are rational creatures. That is the fundamental point that Americans never learned.
Love it. Okay, once again, switching a little bit of gears again, bear with me. You know about the incoming eclipse that's happening in April, correct?
Have you heard?
Okay. Are you privy to in my opinion, wild biblical connections with the upcoming eclipse that's happening in April?
Yeah, I've seen some of them.
And one that I came across, because there's many, they're manifold, is Nineveh. And I'm a lector at my local church, and a few weeks ago I actually did the reading with this I'm not the best at the whole Bible thing, but the story of Nineveh and the idea of repentance, and that these people, that this Nineveh city was doomed, but that they were able to repent, and as such God was able to spare them. And what was shocking, one of the things that picked up, was this whole eclipse is supposed to go over Nineveh, Texas, Missouri, Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, New York, when you hear stuff like that, Dr. Jones, when it comes to the celestial, because in Genesis, I'm sure you know, God gives us, created the sun and the moon, not just for light, but for signs. What is your professional opinion on when it comes to these celestial events and potentially what God may be communicating to mankind?
First of all, it sounds to me as if Nineveh, Texas is the same as the Nineveh of the Bible. Well, that means that America is the new Israel. well, this is Christian Zionism and it's wrong. It's a heresy. It's not the way. There's nothing special about America. This is the problem with America, that it thinks it's some type of successor of God's chosen people. That is precisely the problem. And everything in this thing is predicated on the notion that America is Israel, God's chosen people. We are not. We have to get over that. We got to get over that idea. And then the second point is that somehow, you know, the heavens are where God dwells. This goes all the way back to the beginning. There's some reason we think that God is in the sky. Well, that's primitive. That's primitive. But it still resonates with us. There was a time when if you could figure out the movement of the stars, you know, could I figure out human history? Well, no, that's kind of Neoplatonism. These are all obsolete sciences, obsolete ideologies, and so on and so forth that have no relevance to the situation. So no, just because the eclipse happens in Nineveh, Texas, it has no theological meaning whatsoever.
Good to know.
Dr. Jones, one more thing is I wanted to bring up, as again, and I get so much value from your weekly show, and I remember fairly recently, you had brought up a quote regarding the Bram Stoker's Dracula and Jonathan Harker and his journal, and this quote from it about don't read my diary. But what was the quote again?
Minna shows up at the hospital. So Jonathan Harker has gone to Dracula's castle, and then there's this dreamlike sequence of there are three women involved, and then suddenly he gets ill, and now he's in the hospital in Budapest, and Minna comes and visits her, and he turns to her and he says, "Here is my diary, do not read it." So there's a kind of contradictory statement here, which I think epitomizes the horror genre. This is, I talk about this in my book, Monsters from the Id, and this is the chapter on Dracula, which is basically horror is, it's so bad, I don't want to talk about it. It's so bad, I can't not talk about it because something's bothering me. So we're talking about the troubled conscience here where I have to talk about it, but I don't want to talk about it. And specifically in Dracula, it's about syphilis. And I think this is what Dracula is about. And specifically, the situation where the man goes out and contracts syphilis, then he comes home and he infects his wife with syphilis. Like the wife is an innocent victim. She's got the disease and she didn't commit a sin to get the disease. And the guilt that this creates in the man is just intolerable. There are stories in newspapers about this type of thing. It was a horrible occurrence, but common occurrence in the 19th century where there was no cure for syphilis. So that's what that's about. And horror is a genre where you can't say it directly because it's too horrible. So you have to say it obliquely. And so, for example, in like Alien, the next film I dealt with, this is the sequel to the sexual revolution of the 1970s. It's specifically the sequel to Deep Throat, which was a pornographic film, came out in 73, about oral sex. That's what happens in Alien. This monster sticks his penis down this guy's, John Hurt, that's the character, and then his stomach explodes. That's what sex was by 1979. It will kill you. It's disgusting and it will kill you. And no one would say that. If you asked him specifically, oh yeah, I'm all for sexual liberation. I got a disease, she got an abortion, she broke my heart, but I'm still for it. Well, that's contradictory, and this is why you needed the horror movie to explain it for you.
In listening to that brilliant assessment, two things come to mind, and I think you recently covered this. The word, the operative word, unspeakable, right? In regards to certain types of horror where it's so bad, it's unspeakable, right? And then, So I grew up Nirvana, a band that I liked growing up in the 90s or whatever, still kind of like them or whatever. And I read books about Kurt Cobain, the lead singer, right, who allegedly killed himself back in the 90s, right, with a shotgun. I have here his journals, his book, Journals, and he puts it right on his journals. He put, "If you read, you'll judge." Again, this is somebody who, again, Kurt Cobain issues with heroin addiction and all this fame that he had in Nirvana. And this is a page right from his book, and he says, "Don't read my diary when I'm gone. Okay, I'm going to work now. When you wake up this morning, please read my diary. Look through my things and figure me out."
That's amazing. It's just like Jonathan Harker. That's amazing. I don't know a damn thing about Kurt Cobain.
Okay.
The only thing I know is that he killed himself.
Yeah.
I couldn't hum one tune that he... This is way past my era, you know, of listening to that kind of music.
Well, that sort of thing, when I listen to you, sometimes it'll just be like lightning. I'm like, oh my gosh, that I can connect it to something else that it resonated with me, and this was one instance of that, as because the same kind of theme. And I wanted to mention before we go today is you need to be getting these culture war magazines. I have to tell you, these are not only does Dr. E. Michael Jones have phenomenal books that you need to be reading, but there's also wonderful insight in each of these pages. There's different mini stories by guest authors, and they're all awesome. One of my favorites, and you know, they've been really good ever since I've been subscribing for about a couple years now. This one on Jerry Springer, really good. This is from July, August 2023. A fantastic read, because we all been there, right? Growing up in the 90s, the whole Jerry, it's like this clown show, right? And what was this spectacle about? Read Culture Wars and this magazine to find out. A recent one in February, this one about Confessions of an Ivy League Shiksa. I mean, that was just, I mean, the stuff in here is not going to really shock everybody, but it may shock you as the things that are said and noted in these articles. So definitely it's available via news email. You can get it directly to your email, or you can get print. I recommend print. Dr. Jones, can we have the last word with
you? Yeah, you can go to culturewars.com. That's the only place you're going to find it. If you want the books, it's fidelitypress.org. They're both available. They're interconnected, but that's where you'll find that. And I think it's not just, the magazine is a collaborative effort. So I don't write everything in the magazine. And what you're seeing is that a consensus is forming, a consensus that allows you to make sense of specific things that you've seen before. Like, you know, Jerry Springer just had a great review about in Ireland, this guy who was so influential in Ireland and creating all these sitcoms in Ireland. What he says in his biography is exactly what we've been saying at Libido Dominandi, how the Ireland was taken out by sexual liberation. This is the type of thing you see in Culture Wars on a monthly basis. So thanks for recommending it.
And you're welcome. And thanks for all that you do, Dr. Jones, as well as your staff. Mike does a great job. Big shout out to him, manning the camera and the audio to make sure that this interview is great. Dr. Jones, can we get one more message of hope? Because it seems like we're surrounded by doom and gloom, and people just looking, they're searching. And I know they're searching because the last interview we did together had some 6,000 comments the last time I looked at it on Rumble. So people are searching for the answers, and they're still sort of, we don't want to have to recap how we talked about in the first interview, but what kind of message can we give to the people as far as hope and to not to give up?
Yeah, so if you have the right categories, you will be able to see things that are actually happening. If you have the wrong categories, you're going to be blind, you know? So the whole point of this is establishing the right categories, and that's what the books do. Sexual liberation is a form of political control. That's a category that allows you to see things that the culture does not want you to see. Because, and so, you know, it's just little things like last week. Victoria Nuland's gone. Victoria Nuland is the architect. She's a Jewish lady connected with the Kagan family, which is a very influential Jewish family. She's the one who started the war in the Ukraine. She is the one who's been pushing it, and she's gone. Now, what does that mean? Colonel McGregor said she was pushed. Is this a sign that the times are changing? You have to be able to see it in order to understand what's happening. If you don't, you're going to get too depressed because you're too pessimistic, which is what I've already mentioned that about my interview with Brother Nathaniel. I think you missed, you know, if you just say, oh, it's the Jews are in control and there's nothing we can do about it. That's not true, because God is in charge of human history. And you have to understand how God works in human history, and the word that term that we get from Hegel is the cunning of reason, die List der Vernunft. And so George Galloway was just elected in a riding, Rochdale, in England. This is a significant event. This is breaking the monopoly that Labour and Tories have over that. He was elected because there are a lot of Muslims. I know that there are people who don't like the Muslims coming into their country, but we have to see it from a bigger perspective. The Jews are responsible for flooding all of these European countries with Muslims. But it turns out that when you get to England, the Muslims hate the Jews more than the natives do. And so God brought about, used them to bring about the exact opposite of the Jewish intention that put them there in the first place. Now, if you don't have a category like the cunning of reason, you won't see it. You won't understand it. And so that's why you need to read Culture Wars. That's why you need to keep up, read the books. Because if you don't have the right categories or the right vision, you're going to get depressed and you're going to get hopeless and you're going to fall into despair. And that's not God's plan.
Excellent. All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Jones. Thank you, Mike. And don't lose hope. Embrace Logos. Check out Culture Wars. And definitely check out all of Dr. Jones's fantastic literature work. Thank you very much for watching and listening.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.